All right. Ah, that's better. Okay. So, yeah, my name is Stephen Downs, and just to set the record straight, I should not be called Doctor. I do not actually have a doctorate. So just call me Stephen. That's definitely the way to go. And I'm located here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And it's about 10 in the morning here. And so, which isn't too bad, except for the fact that I got back at 2 a.m. last night from Ontario. So I'm still a little bit jet lagged. And I was up very early this morning because this is actually the second thing that I'm doing today. So, yeah, one of those days. What I'm told is I have about 15 minutes or so. So I'm going to be really brief and breezy. And you're quite right. The name Labatt is based on a beer. Labatt, my history in the internet goes back a long way. And actually, I can date my history on the internet really very precisely because in, what would it be now? 1987, something like that. The philosophy team at the University of Alberta, the graduate student philosophy team at the University of Alberta, was up playing softball, and we all went back to the bar, the chop house. It was a bar and chop house, which is kind of an interesting place. And I remember Jeff McLaughlin and Istvan Barclay were already on this thing called a MUD, and they were telling me about it. And they said, "Well, yeah, and you have to pick a name for yourself." And what a MUD is kind of a text-only version of Second Life, if you will. And so, yeah, a little skeptical, but I've been using computers for a long time at that time. Yeah, and Life on the Screen there, you're referring, of course, to Sherry Turkle's book. And so we're talking about that, and I said, "Yeah, you need to pick a screen name for yourself." I said, "Okay, well, what should I pick?" Not knowing anything. And they said, "Well, it should be something that's easy to type." And Jeff's name was Kane, Kane, and Istvan's name was Nomad. So I'm sort of sitting in this place, looking around, what would be easy to type? And of course, I see the advertisement on the wall, Labatt. And that's how I became Labatt. And so I joined in this MUD. It was called Mud Dog MUD. Based at the University of Florida, virtual reality at its best was the slogan that showed up every time that we would log on. And thus began really my internet career. I started with the internet a bit sooner than that because I started as a tutor with Athabasca University earlier in 1987. And they gave me email and things like that, but really my internet experience begins with my joining the MUD in Mud Dog MUD with Kane and Nomad and a whole bunch of other people. I spent a lot of time in that MUD. What I want to talk about, I guess, is personal learning in a connectivist environment. And what I've been thinking about recently is not so much the technology, because we're really getting to know the technology now. We're getting pretty good at the technology. And I'm more interested in the pedagogical foundations for personal learning that the technology provides. Because what's happening here is we're not just using new technology. This is Second Life, and it's very similar in many ways, except for the visuals and I guess the audio presenting. But it's very similar to the technology that we've had for many, many years. And what's changing is not so much the technology. What's changing is the way that we look at learning using the technology. You know, if you think back to the earlier days of technology-supported learning, the whole program was to manage learning, whatever that means. You know, they actually called them learning management systems, and it was all about flinging resources here and sending quizzes and recording marks and all of that. And that's still, to a large degree, the way that we manage learning today, the way that we organize learning online. But what we're seeing are the changes, and these changes are implemented in what we're now calling personal learning environments or personal learning networks, where we're not trying to manage learning so much as we're trying to create an environment in which people can learn. And when I say environment, I mean that very loosely, because the environment is actually a largish collection of different tools. You know, that's the old classic personal learning environment diagram that Scott Wilson created. And you can see that it links Flickr and 43 things and an LMS and, you know, various other applications that are out there on the internet. And, you know, when we move to that kind of environment, our thinking about knowledge itself changes. Knowledge, as presented in the learning management system, is static. It's like presenting books. It's declarative in the form of propositions. Paris is the capital of France. It's authority-based. You know, this is true because I tell you that it's true. But when we move beyond that environment, when we start working in our own personal learning environment, knowledge becomes something that's dynamic, fluid, tacit, experienced. You know, we learn things by doing things. I don't want to say constructed, because it's not really constructed, but it's more organic, it's grown. And so the personal learning environment from a knowledge perspective is, it's an environment to manage connections, whatever that means, where knowledge consists of this dynamic set of connections. So from a knowledge perspective, a personal learning environment is an environment for a person to manage their own knowledge. And so we can think of a personal learning environment, and indeed connectivist learning generally, as a set of applications, a set of tools, methods, practices, attitudes, ways of looking at, I don't even want to use the word manage, but managing this flow of knowledge, immersing ourselves into this flow of knowledge. So when I developed an application for use during the connectivism course, what I used was something that I wrote called Grasshopper. And what Grasshopper is a tool for managing connections. It's a tool for aggregating or bringing together resources that are out there in the world, bringing them together, letting me work with them, and then letting me send them forward, to feed them forward. By managing these connections, I'm managing the knowledge that I'm immersing myself in as this community interacts with itself, as this community wrestles with the different texts and the different problems. Grasshopper, just for the record, is spelled G-R-S-S Hopper. So I've very cleverly removed the A and thus put R-S-S in there, indicating the connection to RSS. Yeah, all one word like that. And the idea here is that my personal learning environment should be thought of as embedded in a network of other personal learning environments, and all of us together create this largish social network that consists of the connections between our applications and the connections that we forge when we aggregate content from each other, when we work with it and we send the content to each other. And yes, Michigan Paul, we all need a grasshopper. And the large focus of the work that I'm doing these days is to try to get everybody their own grasshopper. So usually now, and this is an important turn that I want to make here, usually now when we talk about learning in this way, the next step we take is to describe some theory of social learning. And George often does this. I don't know if George is here, but George will often now start talking about a theory of social learning, depicting learning as an external process, saying that, I keep my knowledge in my friends and all of that. And that has been common historically. In the history of pedagogy, we've got, behaviorism, interaction theory, social constructivism, problem-based learning, all these externalist forms of social learning. But the turn I want to take is not towards social learning, but rather toward personal learning. Basically, personal learning, the learning that an individual does, is the creation of sets of connections in their own personal neural network. That's how we learn, is we form these connections. And we form these connections not by receiving content, but rather by stimulating and activating our neural network so that these connections grow in the same way that a muscle will grow. And that's why learning is very similar to exercising, and the process is the same. Quite literally, the process of learning about France, of learning mathematics, of learning physics, is quite literally the same as exercising and learning to run a marathon or learning to play hockey. And so the model here is that we are using a social network in order to create a neural network. And that's a very important turn. If you don't have that turn, you don't have the learning, right? Because if you think about it, you can go through all these motions in the social network, and you can go through all the behaviors or all the problem solving, all of that stuff in the world. But if you don't change the internal state of the learner, then learning hasn't occurred. And so we can't separate I don't want to say it that way. We can't talk about learning without talking about the changes that will happen internally. So the model is we use a social network in order to create a neural network. And so our learning outcome is the creation of a state of affairs in the neural network. And what is that state of affairs? Well, that state of affairs is the shaping of a person's neural network in such a way as to embody the concepts, beliefs, practices, ways of thinking, etc., that constitute a discipline. These learning outcomes are not simple, I have possession of a sentence that is true. These are complex learning outcomes. It's the difference between knowing that Paris is the capital of France and what it feels like to have geographical knowledge, what it feels like to be the speaker of a language, what it feels like to just almost intuitively be able to say Paris when somebody asks you what is the capital of France without even thinking about it. Dreyfus talked about expert knowledge as the highest level of knowledge. This is what they're getting at, where you don't go through some sort of process of recollection or process of calculation or running through some sort of representation in order to produce your knowledge. You just know it because your internal neural net is constructed so that you have actually embodied in a complex way the whole way of being that constitutes knowing a discipline. So, and Michigan is saying the brain knows the language. Yes, but not deep structure type stuff. The deep structure is a syntactical representation. It's like deep grammar, right? This isn't the knowledge of a language is, on this theory, not represented as a deep grammar, a deep structure. It is rather, how do I want to put it? The representation of the language in a neural network is not isomorphic with the structure of a language. And that's the key difference between my thinking about how somebody knows a language and Chomsky's. Chomsky will say that the rules, the grammatical rules, are actually instantiated mentally. And I'm saying, no, that's not the case. The rules are an emergent property of the structure of the neural network. So, and the question always becomes, how do you know that somebody knows something? Right, especially if the person doesn't have the sentence "Paris is the capital of France" in their head, and might even get that sentence wrong when asked, if you think about it. So, when I say, the knowledge of geography is something complex and embodies all the different ways of behaving and acting and thinking and values and beliefs and worldviews of a person that we would call a geographer, how do you test for that? Because you just can't ask them, what is the capital of France? Somebody who is not a geographer could answer that question correctly. Somebody who is a geographer might get it wrong in certain cases. Well, basically take that original concept, we use a social network in order to create a neural network, and turn it around. We recognize a correctly formed neural network by that person's performance in a social network. Now, these are not little bits of knowledge or competencies or answers to questions or anything like that. Rather, it's the person's performance in a community of practice, in a social network as a whole. And we recognize, on the whole, that a person is qualified as a geographer. We don't recognize that a person is a qualified geographer because they did this, they did this, they did this, they did this. We recognize that a person is a qualified geographer because in a community of geographers, this person doesn't appear out of place. In a community of geographers, this person can converse naturally and appropriately, intuitively, can make the right sounds, make the right responses, say the right things, will ask the right questions. Yes, almost like fitting in. Exactly like fitting in. And the way other people know that this person is a geographer is not that this person satisfies a certain set of necessary and sufficient conditions. Rather, the way other people know is that they recognize that this person is a geographer. This person is sufficiently similar to their perception, of what a geographer is, that they recognize that this person is a geographer. And you might ask, well, what does that mean? How does that feel? And if you've ever seen the Where's Waldo pictures, I don't know if people could nod their avatars, but if you've ever seen Where's Waldo, and for those of you who don't know, Where's Waldo is you're presented with this really complex picture And somewhere embedded in that picture is a little cartoon character with a striped shirt, a big hat, and glasses. And he's hard to find. And the idea is you look at the picture until you find Waldo. Now, once you've found Waldo in a picture, you can't unfind him, right? There's this snap to awareness. Once you've found Waldo, there he is. And every time you look at that picture after, you see him that way. Well, that's recognizing. You know, that's this snap to awareness. Knowing is recognizing this side. Knowing is looking at that picture and seeing Waldo. So, and that's how you recognize that somebody has become a geographer. So, I think I'll finish there, but you know, I really want to emphasize that when we talk about connectivism and when we talk about learning in social networks, the social network is the tool that we use. And we use that tool, first of all, in order to assist us with our learning. And we use that tool, secondly, to help us assess or evaluate that learning. And so we need to be very careful to keep our activities in the social network distinct in this way from the learning that actually occurs in ourselves. And that allows us to take a different view of the social network. So I'll stop there and see if there's comments, questions, etc. And no questions, no comments. The chat was going like crazy while I was speaking. Okay, we have Jono saying, I agree that learning through environment is an increasing truth, but manipulation of the environment is increasing also. Oh yeah, absolutely. When I talk about participation in an environment, in a social network, I'm not talking about passive participation. Creation and the exercise of creation in that is an essential and important part of learning. And there we go. So yeah, absolutely. You know, if I do the long version of this talk, I always end up talking about constructionism and Papert's approach, because, you know, again, it comes back to, and Papert's thinking the same thing, because he's got a long history of work in connectionist theories of computation. It's a question of how do you create connections between neurons in a human brain? And the way you do that is you practice. And the way you practice is to create, to do things in the environment, experience the result, and the rest. John O'Logo's comment about students being kept on a uni sim is a case in point. I don't know what that means. Students being kept on a uni sim. So I didn't see the original comment, so I don't know what that is. Logo is saying, how can we create effective personal learning environments for virtual worlds that span the worlds themselves, online networks, and real-life networks and contexts? That's actually a really interesting question, because one of the things about something like Second Life in these virtual worlds in general, I spent a lot of time in a place called Active Worlds that it was similar, but before Second Life, is that they're standalone entities. They're closed entities. And so you don't see the networking so clearly. I'm looking at Cavon's comment. It's not just about being in the video game, but what communities say they are involved in outside the video game. Yeah, I think that's it. You know, in the Mud world, they spent a long time, and an ultimately futile time, trying to create something they called Intermud. And what Intermud was a network of muds. And so they tried to create networking that way. You know, I'm just thinking out loud here, so this is not an answer to the question, it's just me thinking out loud. I think that the artifacts are really important. And I think that's one of the things that really made Second Life, you know, the really attractive environment that it was to many people, is that people could create their own environments. So you have this communication by creation and not just passive conversation in a virtual environment. There's social network where people just talk to each other, and there's social networks that evolve around some sort of object. And I think that's why Etienne Wenger would say, you know, a community of practice will revolve around some object. And, you know, you get a lot of people who are talking about network theory, social theory, talking about objects of sociality. So the object itself becomes the entity that creates the connection that creates the social network. So I think I'd want to talk sort of in that kind of language when I'm talking about social networks in Second Life or social networks in virtual communities. But the other thing, too, is the ownership of the self. One of the things that really bothered me about Second Life is I can't be Stephen Downs in Second Life. So I lose all of my connections. I lose all of my associations. I'm Labatt Papa. They force me to be Labatt Papa. Well, they force me to be Papa. I get to pick Labatt. But I can't be me. And, you know, in a genuine, authentic community of practice, we are who we are. We're not, you know, non-self avatars. And so I think that there's a distancing that takes place in Second Life specifically, and sometimes in these virtual worlds generically, a distancing from our other life. But our other life is crucially important to the forming of these social networks, especially to the forming of these social networks in which we learn. And that's why we see people create connections, like this conference here, connections in the virtual world that mirror connections that already exist in the physical world. But there's no way to have a nice isomorphic connection. It becomes a lot harder, a lot more stilted when we're not able to bring our identities from outside the world into the world. Now, the chat's been going crazy here. People eventually have to get their hands dirty. Yes. Many people don't want their real identity in here. Well, yeah. It's funny. It's a funny thing how people sometimes don't want their real identities to be seen. Notion of emergent property of a neural network could help guide teachers trying to teach empathy-based morality. Oh yeah, absolutely. How do I want to put that? I mean, you're dead on with that point. My whole philosophy of morality is based on empathy, and you know, it's so it's I don't ever get the chance to talk about that sort of thing. But, you know, and it's an empathy-based model of learning generally. You know, we always have this picture of teaching where you transmit something by telling or showing or demonstrating or whatever, and the person receives it and in some way stores it. And if you look at the language, especially of the cognitive theorists or the direct instructionists, you look at the language that people use when they're talking about learning, and it's very often that way. But that's not what learning is. You don't get stuff and store it. What happens is, in teaching, what you want to have happen is you want the learner to have an experience. Oh, there goes my clock. Won't be long now. I'm just waiting for the clock to finish. Okay, you want the learner to have an experience that is sufficiently similar to the experience that the instructor had so that the learner will have the same mental consequence as the instructor. In other words, the learner will feel the same thing that the instructor feels, or a similar thing. So really, it's a model of learning by empathy. It's a model of feeling the world the way the instructor or the knower does. So, yeah, it's really hard to articulate something like that in words, but we all know what this feels like. It's, you know, because anytime you've actually mastered something, and everybody in this room has mastered something, anytime you've mastered something, there's that point of time where before you didn't know, and you're feeling your way, you're still thinking about how to do it, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh wait, I just did it without thinking about it. And you have the feeling of what it is to do something. And that's the thing that we're after. So, you know, when we're teaching, we want to put people through a series of experiences and practices that will produce that feeling. It's, you know, this part about constructivism is right. The learner quite literally does construct the learning. But the point where I differ with the constructivists is this is not a cognitive activity. They don't sit down and work it out for themselves. Rather, they construct the experience by growing, or sorry, they construct the knowledge, they grow the knowledge by going through a set of activities and experiences that will produce that knowledge as a neural state, as an emotional, empathetic feeling state in their own mind. I know that was really fuzzy, but that is how people learn. Okay, so this is Michigan Paul summarizing. Put people through experiences and practices. The learner constructs the learning, but it's not a cognitive activity. They grow the knowledge by experience that will produce the knowledge as a neural state. Yes, exactly right. Okay, still looking now at the, I like that. Again, this is an earlier comment from Michigan Paul. Agreed, feel it, or in religious terms, possess or be possessed by the knowledge. Yeah, I like that. And Logo saying, can we not say that we are aiming to stimulate enlightenment? You know, in enlightenment meant in its precise sense, and not, you know, in I don't know, the pop media sense. Enlightenment as in a state of being, a state of awareness, a state of knowing. And Logos is agreeing, good. And Michigan's saying, cool, we have another speaker. I'm not hearing another speaker. All right, anything more? I've run out of comments to be reacting to. Okay, well, this is a great question. The question is this. Why do you think that the learner's possession of the knowledge is parallel to that of the educator? Why not a different route? Well, why not a different route? The other speaker wants to hear more from you. There is no one route. You're absolutely right. And in fact, the whole concept of education as a practice is that subsequent people don't need to take the same route as the person who learned it the first time. This is really important because, you know, it's a way of shortening the path to the having of the same experience. So, you know, this is how we gain our efficiencies in the educational process. Otherwise, you know, we'd teach everybody to swim just by throwing them in the water because that's how the first person learned. But of course, what we do now is we give them a little instruction first, then we throw them in the water. And it turns out that we can create the experience of being able to swim, but we can do it more efficiently. You know, the addition of a little instruction and then throwing them in is more efficient than just throwing them in. What we've done over the years is confuse learning with that little bit of instruction, right? If we understand that what we're after is this knowing how to swim, then the little bit of instruction becomes an aid to producing that cognitive state rather than being the cognitive state that we're trying to produce. So, yeah, many routes, and different people will take different routes. And, you know, this is where I get into arguments with the learning styles skeptics. You know, a person's background, their prior beliefs, their prior experiences, all will inform any determination of what the most efficient way to get a person to that mental state will be. You know, a person who has had prior experience swimming in jello will take one route to learning how to swim in water. A person who's never had that prior experience will take a different route. Not that anybody really has a prior experience of learning to swim in jello, but you know what I mean, right? The past experiences matter. Your belief set matters, and because these things matter, the processes, the experiences, the techniques, all of, you know, the practice, all of these things will be different from one person to the next. And this is why personal learning is so important. This is why setting out our own learning path, managing our own learning, is so important. You can't just sit down and prescribe this stuff. In this part, the learning style skeptics are right. You know, you can't analyze somebody's learning style and say, I'll teach you this way. That'll be the most efficient. Because learning styles are so complex that you can't measure them with sufficient accuracy in order to be able to prescribe an instructional strategy. People know their own learning styles by recognizing you know, and again, it's this idea of, you know, you can see and feel what kind of learning is going to work best for you, and you gravitate toward that type of learning. And so that's how learning styles come into play. They come into play in the sense that if a person is able to manage their own learning, they will manage that learning in a way that best accords to their learning style. Except I don't want to say it quite like that because sometimes they make mistakes. So I want to say it something like, if they can manage their own learning, then they can possibly manage it in such a way as to best adapt to their own learning style. Mud player going into MM or PG, yeah. Mud people like to type. Mud people grew up typing. It's totally, it's funny, it's the same technology, but it's different. Okay, what else have we got in comments here? Ability to learn, a function of prior experience. Yeah, not just ability to learn, but method and practice of learning is a function of prior experience. As educators, we sometimes get new perspectives from the students. Exactly, because everybody's coming at this from a different way, a different way of seeing things. Their way of learning such and such will be different from your way of learning such and such. But as they learn such and such in their way, their process of creating things and communicating things gives you a new experience of such and such. That's why teaching is such a rewarding experience, because you get to see the world through all your students' eyes. It's a really wonderful experience. People talking about typing. And John was saying it requires multiple modes of instruction to be available for me to choose my preferred mode. Yeah, there's a minimum of two factors at work here, right? First of all, there has to be a choice in, there has to be a range of selection in the approach to learning, and then secondly, you have to have the capacity to make that choice among them. So, yeah. If you're only given one way of learning, who cares if you have choice? Okay, I'm going to turn off the speak button now, and I think I've probably, it's 11 o'clock my time. I think we should probably move on to the next speaker. And I've recorded this entire talk in audio, and I'll make that available on my website later on. And so if anybody wants to go back to it, my website is, for those of you who don't know, downs.ca. And so that'll be up on my website later this afternoon. So thanks a lot, everyone. I hope you found this interesting and informative. And I'll see you in the real world.